All right. So, well, thank you for Daniel and Cynthia for inviting me and for participating in this symposium and the resulting publication. So, as Cynthia said, my task was kind of give a soils perspective, and I'll try to touch base. I'm not going to give a complete thing because we don't have all day. Okay. So, Daniel showed this figure before, and I'll just highlight a couple things in here on that. And one, here's the soil pool, which in this diagram is about 1,600 gigatons of carbon that's in the soil. But you got to put that in context. In the atmosphere, it's around 750 and increasing a little bit, so there's twice as much carbon in the soil as there is in the atmosphere, and about three times as much carbon as in green vegetation. So people think all the carbon is in the vegetation. Well, that's not necessarily true. It's all a large part of it is in the soil, at least the part that we manage, that vegetation, the atmosphere, and the soils. Of course, if you want to look at bigger pools, then there's the oceans and sediments and that. But the key point here is, particularly for agriculture, small changes in the soil carbon content can have significant contributions in this carbon balance. And I'll highlight a little bit of that. Okay. Maybe I'll go there. No?
Left click.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Right, try right click.
How about if I just page down?
Yes.
Okay. All right. For whatever reason. The other part, we talk a lot about carbon, the other significant greenhouse gas, particularly from soils, is that of nitrous oxide. And this is from the IPCC and Phil Robertson, some other publications. And about 85% of the N2O, let me back up, about 8% of the N2O is making the contribution to greenhouse gases, CO2 equivalents. 85% of that is associated with agriculture, and 50% of that is shown here. I'm afraid to touch this mouse since it was locking up. But 50% is coming from agriculture soils, primarily due to nitrogen additions, whether it's fertilizer, biologically fixed nitrogen. The nitrogen enhancement is contributing to that source. And we'll see how this works. Okay. So in the latest version of IPCC, which I served on, we came up with an assessment of the potential, the economic potential, Daniel, that looked at the mitigation potential for different sectors at different carbon prices. Okay. So what you see here is energy supply, transport. Oh, this is by 2030, so about 20, 25 years from now. Industry, ag, forestry, and waste. Okay, the key point here, and actually I was kind of surprised when we compiled all this information, was, as you might expect, or kind of suspect, that at least over the next 20 years, buildings, conservation have the biggest mitigation potential. So energy savings, better insulation, lighting, heating in buildings. What was kind of surprising to me, and many of us as we compiled this, was that agriculture, depending on carbon price, but agriculture was tied for second in its mitigation potential. And again, remember, this is over the next 20 years, so things that are immediately available are doable. And that's why it had a bigger potential than transportation or energy supply, because it's going to take time to redo our infrastructure. You're not going to, you know, shut down a coal-fired power plant. It's going to take time to retool that, and there's some technology advancements that are needed to increase the efficiency of energy and alternative energy sources. Same thing with transportation. We're not going to, you know, we got a huge infrastructure right now. And, you know, in the U.S., just to build a bridge, it takes 10 years of planning and going through all the permits and that. So it takes time to do all that stuff. So ag has a huge, significant potential, particularly in the short and medium term. And so within agriculture, a large proportion of that mitigation potential of agriculture excluding bioenergy, arises from soil carbon sequestration. About 85% of the mitigation potential was in carbon sequestration, again, over the next 20, 30 years. And this has strong synergies with sustainable agriculture and generally reduces the vulnerability to climate change, and I'll try to highlight a couple of those. So it's part of that adaptation, so there's the synergy between mitigation and adaptation. And so those practices we're looking at is increasing carbon sinks, reducing greenhouse gases, N2O and methane, and also the potential, and we've got to be careful about this, biomass feedstocks for energy supply. And if we broke that down, Pete Smith and myself and others looked at some of the individual practices that where that mitigation potential would exist. And if you look at the biggest potential here was cropland management. And again, the blue is the carbon sequestration piece, a little bit of contribution of N2O. Grazing land management, mostly due to carbon, soil carbon, and then restoration of cultivated organic soils. And again, a large part of that's carbon. This is animal agriculture over here for methane and rice management, methane, improving efficiencies and reducing methane emissions. But again, in the short term, a large proportion of it is related to soil carbon, as Daniel suggested as well. Okay, so what do you do to control that carbon balance? So this is a diagram I often use in my class and other presentations. So you got to think about inputs and outputs. And except for the photosynthetic bacteria, the largest input into the system is through the plants. And so carbon photosynthesis, CO2 uptake, that green matter, then it's that residue and the roots that are feeding the microorganisms, and they are cycling in there, the engine, the driver for that recycling of that carbon and stabilizing it in soil. That's controlled by climate, particularly moisture and temperature. And I often say that's something we don't readily control, although we're impacting that. But other than irrigation, we don't quickly change the climate, but in the long term we are. Soils, and primarily the soil type, mineralogy, the clay content, all that affects the capacity of that soil to sequester carbon. But again, other than that, like a baseball field, you're not going to go and change the texture or clay content of a 1,000 or a couple thousand acre field. So, but what we can change is the management, and that's where the biggest potential is. So just, again, because of the time frame, I'm not going to be able to go through everything, but we worked with a group that looked at the biophysical mitigation potential of several practices, and I just highlight three here. No-till, and this is for the U.S., on average, looking at the literature, meta-analysis, about 1.1 tons of CO2 equivalents per hectare per year. But look at the variability. That range from minus 0.26 to 2.6. And again, this is tons of CO2 equivalent, so you got to divide that by 3 to get it carbon equivalents per hectare. Winter cover crops, again, 0.83, a range there, but mostly on the positive side, or on the positive side. And then diversifying annual crop rotations. And I've often been on record saying we need to diversify and intensify our agriculture systems. Intensify getting rid of the fallow, using cover crops, and then diversifying. Particularly in the soybeans, we need to diversify those cropping systems. So I'll just use, no, oh, well, let me back up. This range I mentioned here for no-till was negative to positive. And the reason, so a lot of people say, well, no-till is not going to work. First comment on that, you got to think about the system. It's just not no-till. It's the whole cropping system you need to look at. Secondly, we need to look at where those negative numbers are coming from. And so this, probably a lot of you have seen this. Stephen Ogle did a meta-analysis several years ago looking at the various studies, no-till here is on your right. There are some negative values here in that. But on average, there's a lot of positive and increases to quite extensively in a few studies. There are some places where no-till doesn't sequester carbon or even reduce till. So we're working on a publication. We've done looking at a range of different systems for no-till. And by the way, this is measuring all the way down to 60 to a meter in depth. Okay, so we're looking at deeper, not just the surface. And in fact, you see some negative values here. And then as we've gone this transect across North and part of South American continents, we see positive values of 1.2, and we pretty much try to stay with corn soybean systems so that we can make some relative comparisons, and 1.6 to 0.6, and in parts of Brazil, 0.42. I think at least our analysis thinking is that in those cool, poorly drained soils, that's where it looks like the pockets where no-till doesn't have that positive benefit. And a lot of those are the upper Midwest and the eastern Canada, Ontario. So it's that poorly drained systems where no-till has less of a positive impact. But the thing you have to think about, too, is where those areas that no-till or conservation agriculture is adapted to. One is we know it restores carbon, but there's a lot of other benefits. One, it conserves moisture. So again, this is the area where reducing vulnerability to climate or precipitation is really key. It also saves fuel, so that means agriculture is contributing less to its own emissions by the fuel conservation. And there's some other benefits: lower machinery costs, reduces erosion, improves fertility, and some of those on there. So you got to look at those synergies that make it more valuable to do, whether it's this conservation ag or some other practice. We need to look at those synergies that make it more economically viable. On the nitrous oxide emissions, again, looking at some of those no-till, there's been some reports, there's several reports that show that no-till might increase N2O on average 0.18, but the range is quite large there, 0.9 in greater emissions to 0.72 less emissions. Winter cover crops, again, are going to reduce the emissions, and diversifying annual cropping systems, a little bit of range there, but some positive benefit. But let's look at the N2O emissions from tillage. I have here, this is some work that we've done, there's more data on this, but a couple points here is that N2O emissions in agriculture systems, for all that have worked in this area, you know that it's quite variable, okay, highly dynamic. This is 1 year, and I'll show the in-year summaries here, but this year, 2009 looks completely different than 2010, all right, and day-to-day it will vary. But if we look at the cumulative N2O emissions, this is for those summaries. No-till in 2009 was actually less with fertilizer than tillage. So no-till isn't always going to increase N2O emissions. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. The manure or composting, there's a less difference here. 2010 was an extremely wet year, and in that year the emissions were the same. Not greater, but the same between the two tillage systems. So we've got to be careful of making some general conclusions here. And like Daniel said, it's site-specific, and we need to think about the system. But as N2O mitigation potentials, there are several things on here, and the reference dropped off, but it's Phil Robertson. But looking at soil emissions, things that generally we should be doing anyway to improve fertilizer efficiency, looking at soil nitrogen tests, different timing placement, rates, cover crops, fertilizer placement, nitrification, urease inhibitors. These are potential reductions in N2O emissions as well as improving crop and use efficiency, and 20% potential reduction by improving crop and use efficiency. So all those kind of make sense, both from a profitability standpoint as well as an environmental standpoint. So with the mitigation opportunities for agriculture, and as part of the discussion, we need to look at offsets. Soil carbon is certainly the one that's been online, online. There's been a voluntary market. There are some markets. Alberta, Canada has an operating system now. And if I've been following all the politics right, Australia has implemented a carbon tax. I think that passed, although Prime Minister might not sign that, might veto. But anyway, the idea there is that will provide an incentive, a cap and trade. And again, Alberta set the cap and then let the market find the best solutions. And agriculture is part of that solution, and that's an operating system. And I forgot now the value, but in Alberta, the ag component is making up more than the majority of the offsets. And that's in no-till and rotations. But then there's the grassland potential, rangeland, as well as for soil carbon. Nitrous oxide reductions, I kind of show that, but by improving fertilizer efficiency, that's going to reduce those emissions. And again, how we provide the incentives is going to be, I think, a little bit more difficult, but certainly doable. But then I think we need to think about the, you know, agriculture is a highly energy intense system. Where we can increase the energy efficiency of our ag systems is going to help reduce agriculture's emissions to the CO2. And so no-till, again, things like that should help. So, and again, it's not just about carbon, it's not just about nitrous oxide or just about climate change. I think you have to put the whole package together. And I have carbon here at the center of the universe, but in my triangle, because I'm a microbiologist, that carbon there is to feed the microbes, and that interplays with soil structure. And if we think about those three components, carbon, structure, and microbial activity, they're all interrelated, but then they impact the whole system. They improve biodiversity, you get more organic matter, you have more nutrient recycling, soil structure is going to have better water erosion, or improved water, or less water erosion, and maintain that water, again, to help adapt to climate change. And that's going to have a positive benefit on plant growth yield. And then you have the outside triangle with environmental services, gaseous emissions, and sustainability. So we have to think of it as a package there, and that improves the value of that system. So to conclude, agriculture does have a significant role to play in climate mitigation. Agriculture is cost competitive with mitigation options in other sectors, particularly some of the things that talked about geologic carbon storage. I don't like to call it sequestration. But agriculture, at least in the short term, is a player and should be a player in this game, and also improves the sustainability of that ag system. So we need to think about that. And with that, I thank you and entertain questions. Good question. It depends on the policy and how you set the rules. Okay, you can have temporary credits. You can have a permanent credit. In ag systems, I do not think a land manager is going to sign up for a 100-year permanent reserve. But there are ways to accommodate that. Alberta's basically, they set aside 20% of their carbon offsets every year in a permanent reserve, and they take them offline. And so that's a way to avoid risk of reversal. and set up some confidence in that system. But, you know, again, you have to think about, I'm sorry about using no-till, but it's a good example, but reduced tillage or no-till, you know, if that has a positive benefit on soil fertility and soil structure, a land manager, a farmer, is not going to likely be willing to change that system. It has all these other benefits. So we need to look at that system and then worry about the reversals. Yeah. Oh, sorry. You're in control. Sorry.
Yes, and then Dan.
Are the projected benefits due to no-till based on the continuation of no-till in areas that already practiced that, or also new areas coming into no-till that haven't practiced before? And if it is partially the latter, why haven't those areas already come on board in times past? So
right.
What are the barriers to getting that going in those areas?
Oh, boy. How long do we have? That's a really good question, and part of it is a fear of change. Okay, farmers tend to be conservative and less risky, I guess, and it's the fear of change. You also got to look at the age of the farmer. Many, at least, I don't know about elsewhere, but in the U.S. and in the Midwest. A lot, not all, but the younger farmers are adopting those new technologies a lot easier. I talked to a Canadian farmer. We were on a panel, and part of his thing was they just didn't want to change. They were comfortable. They were making that money, and making that change, the risk of making a change, if there was a concern that there might be a slight yield reduction for even a few years, and we haven't seen that. Some people do. But that's a risk. And no-till or conservation ag is more intense as far as the management, the human side, the human capacity side. Tillage can kind of cover up a lot of mistakes. Okay, so there's a variety of reasons. And you know, people say, well, no-till's been going on for a long period of time. You know, there, for as continuous no-till, our acreage, at least in the U.S., is, I don't know, we don't have good numbers, but some are 20%, Gary, you think? Pete? Less than that? Yeah. I was trying to be generous. in some of the numbers in Kansas, the continuous no-till is probably around 10-12%. So, yeah, there's lots of different reasons.
Dan, your question?
Oh,
to be the last, but we'll have plenty of time for questions later. Yeah.
If we're going to encourage and reward practices that retain and even sequester carbon in the soil, we have to have a method of monitoring it.
Good point, yeah.
And it is extremely difficult to monitor farm by farm or field by field. Each field is heterogeneous. Each farm is heterogeneous. Each region is heterogeneous. How can we develop a reliable mechanism, perhaps by remote sensing, so that the rewards will be well-based and justified?
Good point. So we had an article in EOS at the beginning of the year. It's a very good lead question. You're right. We can't measure carbon. We can measure soil carbon in every field, but it's not going to be practical or it's be expensive. But I think what we need to do, you know, if I was the benevolent king dictator, what we need to have. I think what we need to have is some reference sites to document soil carbon in some key areas and strategically spaced out. But then we're going to have to use a combination of modeling and remote sensing. And if you looked at that diagram, if we know moisture and temperature and the soil type and start remotely sensing crop productivity, we can remote sense even tillage. And then I think we dump those into models, and you have your reference sites as ground truthing, and I think that's going to be the way to go, at least my point of view.
Thanks, Jeff.
All right. And apologize, I got to go run to give another talk, but we'll be back.
Okay,
so.
Great, Chuck. Thanks.
For a third talk.
for more discussion. Thank you very much.